theater-wide biotoxic and chemical warfare. This didn't come from Protovision.
You bet it didn't. Ask him where it did come from, Jim. Go ahead, ask him.
I told you already.
Looks military to me. Definitely military. Probably classified, too.
Yeah, but if it's military, why does it have games like checkers and backgammon?
Maybe because those are games that teach basic strategy.
Jim, how do I get into that system? I want to play those games.
You're not supposed to see any of that stuff. That system probably contains a new data encryption algorithm. You'll never get in there.
Hey, I don't believe that any system is totally secure. I bet you Jim could get in.
Yeah, I bet you
he couldn't. I bet you he could.
Well, you'll never get in through the frontline security, but you might look for a back door.
I can't believe it, Jim. That girl's standing over there listening and you're telling about our back doors?
Mr. Potato Head, back doors are not secrets.
Yeah, but Jim, you're giving away all our best tricks.
They're not tricks.
What's a back door?
Well, whenever I design a system, I always put in a simple password that only I know about. That way, whenever I want to get back in, I can bypass whatever security they've added on. That's basically what it is.
Yeah?
Okay, you really want to get in, find out as much as you can about the guy who designed the system.
Ah, come on, I don't even know the guy's name.
Where are you guys dumb? You guys are so dumb. I got this thing all figured out. I figured it out all by myself.
Oh, yeah, Melvin? How would you do it?
The first game on the list. Go right through Falcon's Maze.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Stuff We've Seen. This is Jim. I know, my little theme song. No, every week it'll be a new theme song. This is Jim. Hey, everybody, but guess what? Now, here's a man who's just been assigned as the personal chef, masseuse, and caddy for the duration of Paul Manafort's country club prison stay. Teal. And don't worry, sir. I've just got a hankering notion that it's going to be a very short prison stay.
It is,
thanks to pardons and whatnots.
Got a good list of movies for me and my friend Paul to watch.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Brewster's Millions.
Yeah, we have a whole bunch of prison movies.
Well, there's some comedies too, so, you know.
We're going to watch Brubaker. We're going to watch
Stir Crazy for some laughs.
Chained Heat. Yep, the Linda Blair classic.
Oh, we're just going to laugh our way through another episode. It seems like every week we start the show off with a long-distance death dedication.
The long-distance death dedication.
No, I mean, it seems like every week we lose another star in Hollywood.
Yeah.
And this one is kind of an interesting. He really wasn't a big movie star.
No, he did a couple of movies.
Yeah, and he wasn't even like a huge television star. I mean, he didn't have a long career of big hit after big hit.
No, but he had, well, we're talking about Luke Perry.
Yeah, so Luke Perry died unexpectedly.
Yes.
You know, and
at age 52.
And that's, I think, what is shocking. I mean, sure, there's a lot of tragic deaths.
Yeah.
People die all the time, and they don't always live into their 70s and 80s. But for people of a certain generation, which we belong to.
Yeah.
It's shocking because I think it really hits home of how fragile life can be.
Yeah.
It could be over in a second.
And, you know, I actually watch Riverdale.
Oh, no.
Yes.
You do?
Yes.
I do not watch Riverdale. Well, do your kids watch? Yeah. Is that it?
Yeah.
Please say that it's because your kids watch it.
I actually watch Riverdale, and it, you know, Luke Perry is great on the show, and it's.
Well, he was great.
He was great. I don't know how they're going to deal with it on the show, but he was still working and still, you know, out there.
Yeah, I mean, I can't say I have all these great Luke Perry movie memories.
Wait, you don't remember seeing 8 Seconds and loving it?
No.
Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Speaking of 8 seconds, I remember he was in The Fifth Element for about 8 seconds.
He is in The Fifth Element for about 8 seconds.
Yeah, he's like a little cameo.
Yeah.
The fact is that Beverly Hills 90210 was a sensation.
Was a sensation, yes.
And the thing is, you know, those who just know about the show but didn't grow up in that time, Fox, the broadcasting network, they were pretty much a joke.
Yes.
And they had got one hit, which was The Simpsons had just started, and that was kind of a sensation, but yeah, they really didn't have anything else. But they had this teen drama.
They didn't even have original programming 7 nights a week.
And also they broke the rules of television with Beverly Hills 90210 because they put brand new episodes on during the summer.
Yes.
Which was like forbidden. You're like, you do not do that.
They did this little short summer season.
And that actually is what really helped propel it.
Yes, because there was no competition.
I'd heard about it. It was becoming a big thing, and I knew there were some guys with sideburns, but I wasn't, that's what I'd heard. It was like, there's a couple of guys, these dreamboats with sideburns, and I wasn't watching the show, but you were.
Yeah, I watched the show just as a campy, guilty pleasure.
And that's what it became for me. I returned home after college. I went out to California for a year or so, and I came back, and a buddy of mine from back home, we just decided it would be funny to start watching 90210.
Yeah.
And we watched it from the first year they went to college. And every week we just churned out so we could laugh.
Well, basically, yeah. Yeah. It was a funny show and super melodramatic and silly. And but there was something, I don't know, it had something to it.
It had its charms.
It had its charms. Exactly.
Okay, so, you know, because why we're even mentioning all this is it got me thinking of a movie story, and it doesn't really have a strong 90210 connection, but
it has a really weak 90210 connection.
When we were living in New York City way back when, there was a year, my junior year at NYU, where you and I were roommates.
Yes.
And we had this friend, John, and he was really your friend. And, you know, I guess I was a friend by association, but he hung out with us a lot.
Yes.
Sometimes too much. No, but he was,
it was hard to get rid of him.
He was over a lot.
Yes.
He lived in the dorms at NYU.
And he had a roommate.
He had a roommate, Greg.
Yes.
And Greg was an actor.
Yeah. Greg, at one point during that year, was on a soap opera, Days of Our Lives, maybe?
That's right.
Yeah, he did a couple of months on a soap opera.
This was not uncommon, by the way. A lot of NYU film and acting students, they were working actors.
Yes, they were working actors, exactly. They kept his character but replaced him after about 3 or 4 months.
Yeah, he had like, you know, one of those bad lucks, or I guess for every actor who makes it, there's one that doesn't quite get there. And he was always up for some part.
Yeah, and he was up for 90210.
We'd hear these reports from John that he was very close to getting this lead on a series, you know.
Yes.
Maybe a pilot. And, of course, pilots don't necessarily go anywhere.
And at the time, I remember the show was called Beverly Hills High School.
Oh, is that what it was?
Yeah.
And, of course, just anything that was like a high school show, I was in college, so it doesn't really, you know, it didn't resonate. But he was up for the show, and he was almost signed. And at the last minute, the story goes, they decided to recast him with somebody who had a little bit more of a name recognition, an actor from Canada who had been on like some Canadian series.
Right.
And this little guy named Jason Priestley.
Yep.
While we knew Greg, the show hadn't really come on yet. And then the show comes on, and it's a monster smash. And,
yeah.
For years, you and I used to joke that, like, every time, you know, Jason Priestley was cashing a check, Greg was probably off in a corner smoking crack or something because he was so bummed out, which is terrible. I mean, I don't know him, and I don't know where he is, but it's just...
I know. I hope he's not a listener.
Yeah, well, I'm going to play the odds on it that he's not. But okay, Greg, we love you. And while we're mentioning that is because in beginning of March... of 1991, so we're almost 30 years ago, There was a movie that was coming out. It was supposed to come out the previous summer, but there was some kind of snags and recuts and reshoots and whatnot. So,
oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, well, you forget these days.
Yeah.
But there was a movie that, I don't know, I don't think you were looking forward to it as much as I was, but it was Oliver Stone's The Doors.
Yeah, I think, I don't know why I wasn't looking forward to it as much.
Well, you know, you were a little bit more cynical and you were like, well, I don't care about it.
I think I was a little bit more cynical. And I was also, I think, in a little bit of a anti-Oliver Stone place.
There you go. And so, you know, it was one of those things where beginning of the year, after all of the, you know, Oscar year-end films have come out and we've kind of seen those, you're just waiting for a brand new movie to get excited about.
Right. After the February dumping ground, you're hoping that March will give you something watchable.
You know, here it is. Oliver Stone, he's always over the top. I mean, he'd only made a few movies to that point.
Yeah.
He'd made Salvador. He made Platoon, Talk Radio, Born on the 4th of July. I think that was it.
I think that was it, yeah. But he was already a big name.
Yeah. And so, you know, it was one of those things where people looked forward to seeing what he was going to do next.
Yeah.
So The Doors was coming out, and it was going to be at the Ziegfeld Theater.
Yes.
In Midtown.
A great old movie palace.
Yeah, and it was going to be in 70mm, six-track Dolby. And it seemed like, wow, it's going to be like this big, you know, kind of like wild concert. So if we're going to see this opening day, we should go to the Ziegfeld.
Exactly. Yeah. And I loved going to the Ziegfeld. I would go there all the time for stuff.
And I think that was the draw for you was, you know, let's get a little crew together and let's go see it. And so we had planned this out. You were very busy during that.
Yeah, I was.
Time.
Yeah.
You were working for your cousin, and you really, your weeks were getting pretty full, but you were going to be available that night. So we planned ahead, and it was going to be you, me, John, of course, Greg, his roommate, this actor, and that's kind of what made me think of Greg in the first place and the whole Luke Perry connection.
Right.
And then we had a fifth member of this little party, this gal named Fifi.
Yes.
Wasn't her real name, but that's what she sort of went by. And she was hanging out with us a lot that year. So we didn't meet her until close to the end of the fall of 90. And so she started hanging around, just kind of became part of our little network.
Right. The little gang.
Yeah, so she was all up for it. So that was going to be our party. And it was all set. We were going to go, you know, New York, usually go to like the 10 o'clock movie. Sometimes just, you know, you go to a midnight. You don't usually even leave your house till 10.
Right.
we were all going to go up, get there early, get tickets. Because this was before, you know, you didn't buy tickets in advance.
You had to go there. And sometimes I would go several hours early and buy tickets and then like go out, get something to eat, and then go back to the theater and get to the theater 45 minutes in advance so you could get a seat.
And that was not uncommon.
No, that was the way it was done. I mean, it's funny. I've sort of habituated this idea of getting to the movies early. And in my little town right now, everyone gets there basically when the movie starts. I get there about 15 minutes early and there's nobody in the theater.
That is exactly my whole habit from just as a kid. Maybe it was from my dad, but I mean, we would just go and be probably the first ones there in the theater to pick our seat.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just in the habit of getting to the movies early, and it's just not really necessary where I live. But
even when I go back to my my family in Massachusetts, there, most of the theaters are reserved seats.
Right.
Which take the fun out of it for me.
that's just wrong.
As a matter of fact, you know, my whole habit was, hey, I'm going to get there early because I want to make sure I get a ticket and get a seat. And that's all been ruined. Now you actually have to really plan in advance because these theaters are all tiny and it's all reserved and people do it online. And if you don't plan 2 or 3 days in advance to go to the movies, you're out.
Yeah, basically. My small town multiplex is basically the same experience that it would have been 30 years ago.
Mine is not quite the same because it's a crappy multiplex.
Okay.
You know, I mean, it's like sound can be really spotty. The other day I went, saw that Lego movie with the kids And our screen was fine, but I was searching around the other seats to get a booster for my youngest.
Yeah.
And I peeked in because I could hear a movie starting, and back to the Green Book. I looked in and I could see Mahershala and Viggo. Their whole faces were covered in huge soda stains.
Oh, man.
This, I mean, it was the worst. I used to work in a movie theater as a teen. These were the worst soda stains I've ever seen on a movie screen.
Yeah, so somebody throws their soda at the screen.
Those are the kind of cinema crimes, man, that I would be locking somebody up for 47 months. That's the white-collar crime there. Cinema injustice. Okay, so we're off track. March 1st, 1991. So let's take you back the day before. It's a Thursday. I was finishing up a shift at the photo department. And it was like, I don't know, 6:30 at night or something. And I was just going to head back to the apartment. Don't know what you were up to, but, you know, we had our own lives and you were very busy, as I mentioned.
Yeah.
And I'm out in front of the main Tisch building, School of the Arts. And there was a girl that I knew named Melanie from my sound class that I was taking that semester. And she was with her friend. You met her once.
Well, then I definitely will not remember.
We went to this bar, in a Colombian bar, up near Colombia with Molina.
Yes.
And this girl that was like a friend of hers. I think her name was Nancy. That's it.
Yep. Don't remember.
Okay. Well, anyways, this girl Nancy was there, and then this girl Melanie's roommate. And they were all hanging around. There was like kind of a lot of people hanging around, and they bumped into me and said, "Oh, hey, what are you up to?" And I was like, "Oh, nothing." And they're saying, "Well, guess what? They're showing the Doors downstairs in the basement. It's a special preview." And we were thinking we could go downstairs and see if, you know, we could get in. And I, at that moment, you know, I kind of thought I maybe, you know, Melanie was kind of cute and I thought I had a little bit of a crush on her.
Right.
And so now I have this girl, Melanie, asking me if I want to go and join her and her friend down in the basement. I'm like, sure. I have nothing going on. I completely forgot we were going the next day to see it at the Ziegfeld.
Right.
So we go down, and normally this, you will remember this, that theater downstairs at the 720 Broadway was the worst.
Yep, terrible.
It had about 100 seats, a small little screen, and they had these big poles that you could literally get stuck behind and not be able to see anything. A lot of times these screenings were so crowded that if you did get in, you had to stand.
Yes.
And I saw a couple of movies that way. There's nothing worse than having to stand for a movie. I didn't have to stand for the Doors, but we had to sit in the very front row.
Yes.
And I hate that. And so then the movie starts, and, you know, it's just this bigger than life depiction of the Doors in the late
60s. It's a little cartoony almost.
It is. It's way over the top. And, you know, we talked about Bohemian Rhapsody probably, you know, messing with the facts. I can only imagine that maybe only like 5% of the Doors movie is true. But it's just, you know, it was like for a lot of fun and being so close, I just felt like I was right there in the middle of a concert. So I walked out of that movie like on a total buzz thinking this was the greatest. And then I got back and you were in the apartment. And I started just raving about this movie, saying it was the best. And I, you know, "Don't worry. I know we're seeing it tomorrow. I kind of forgot, but it's going to be awesome. We're going to love it." So I get you psyched up, and you hadn't been that excited about seeing the Doors. And I just saw it at the campus. It was only in 35 millimeter. Didn't have any of the super sound, but it sounded good. So I was still looking forward to seeing it in 70 millimeter at the Ziegfeld. So flash forward the next day, the five of us, we get up there. And we got there around 8 o'clock for like a 10 o'clock show. And I think we thought we would do just what you said. We would, you know, get tickets, maybe pal around a little bit, maybe get some coffee.
Go to Gray's Papaya.
Yeah. Two dogs, one drink, $1. And then we would, you know, get in line. We get there and it was a mob scene.
Yes. Total mob.
There was lines like around the block and then around the corner and then the other block. And we discover that the 10 o'clock show is sold out.
Yes.
And now we're all the way up there. And, you know, when you're starving, young
student
idiots, I was calling idiots like we were. We didn't think that we'd want to spend money to go back downtown empty handed. So we said, well, let's just hang out and we're going to get tickets for the 12:30 show.
Yes.
All right. So I mean, it's 8 o'clock and I don't think I had the sense that Fifi was like, oh, I want to just go home. But we were saying we're going to stay for the whole thing. So we get our tickets and now we have to figure out something to do. So we head out into Central Park after dark.
Yes.
And we were wandering around and we were lost in there for about a good half hour or more. And we come out and this must have been a conversation that happened along the way.
Mm-hmm.
But you mentioned, hey, I know someone who lives around here. Does you remembering this yet or no?
Yeah, keep going. Keep going.
So basically, Teal, you knew these casting directors.
Yes.
And I knew them too. And they're actually, they became very famous way after we met them.
Yes. Right after we met them, not long after that, they did The Sopranos.
So it's Walken and Jaffe. It was Georgianne Walken, right?
Yep, Georgianne Walken and Sheila
Jaffe. And Georgianne Walken, and we don't usually mention last names, but somebody who's famous.
Well, yes, you'll see their names on stuff, Walken and Jaffe casting.
And Georgianne Walken is still married to Christopher Walken.
Yes.
And she and Sheila were a crazy team.
Yes, they were a crazy team.
They were a lot of fun. They were kind of wild. And anyways, Sheila Jaffe, I guess, lived not too far an apartment off of Central Park East. No, I'm sorry. I think it was Central Park West.
It was Central Park West, yeah.
Yeah. You know, those details matter, right?
They do, yeah. This was not an East Side story.
No, it's still a West Side story. So, you know, so I think the joke was that, oh, we should, you know, ring her up, see if she's home. And, you know, you kind of initiated the discussion, but I think pretty quickly you were like regretting it.
Yeah, because, you know, it's I'm always conscientious about not just stopping in on people randomly.
But here was the kicker. Greg, who was an actor, he never missed a beat
or right.
an opportunity to be introduced to a casting director. So he was very interested. So we get to the apartment. And I remember there was this nervous hesitation. And I don't know why, but I guess because we're all like 19 or whatever.
Right. And we're going to see a grown-up.
Yeah. And I know that Fifi and John did not feel comfortable.
Right.
They didn't want to come in. And so they said, well, I don't know what's going to happen, but we're going to stay out.
Yeah.
So they stayed outside and we're like, well, if she's even there, right? She probably won't be. But if she's there, we'd only be there for like 2 minutes just to say hi.
Right.
It'll be a funny gag. So we ring the buzzer and lo and behold, on a Friday night at 9 or whatever at night, Sheila Jaffe is home alone.
Yep.
And she's surprised, but she rings us in.
Yes.
So next thing you know, John and Fifi are like looking at the three of us going upstairs. So we go up and she was kind of like tickled and a little delighted and confused that.
Yeah, but she thought it was kind of fun.
She did. And she offered us a beer.
Yep.
And I remember that we each had a beer.
Yeah.
So she was serving alcohol to minors. which is weird, is in New York City, because people didn't drive, it was a thing where people didn't really think about it. You just went to a bar and you had a drink and nobody really paid attention.
No, you never got carded at a bar back in those days. It's probably different now, but at the time, if you were 19, you just could drink in a bar, no problem.
Yeah, there was actually, I remember it was a time we used to go to this one bar that was next to CBGB's, their little sister bar, and we would drink there with no problem. And then one time, because the owner of CBGB's wife was in there,
right,
and his son ran the bar, he had to card. And I was so used to never being carded that I didn't know what to do and completely forgot that I had a fake ID in my wallet. And I had to say I didn't have ID because I forgot about it because I never needed to use it.
We both had those fake IDs that we got from your roommate or something.
No. I didn't know you had one, too.
Oh, I had one, too.
It was from that friend of Gideon's.
Oh, that's right. Yes. But he had like all this stuff on his computer and he would print them out.
Yes, of different states.
Yeah.
And they didn't look anything like the states because I actually dated someone from the state.
Oh, no, they were the worst fake IDs ever.
I think I had to use it twice and it worked both times, but I felt weird about it and I was happy that I never had to. Like I said, I completely forgot when the guy asked for my ID.
So anyhow, we're at Sheila's.
We're at Sheila's and... I mean, I don't know if there's any more to that part of the story that you remember, because I don't remember much there.
Yeah, there's some stuff I remember about the conversation that I don't want to share.
Ooh. See? Great. So the best part of that I don't remember, you don't even want to share. So, hey, whatever. That's okay.
I remember we talked a little bit about Eric Roberts.
Huh. Okay.
Who would... recently been fired off a movie for throwing a fit and kicking over a box of lenses.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
It was like $250,000 worth of lenses.
Oh, my God. Well, that's right, because didn't she know Julia when Julia was like struggling nobody?
No. Sheila used to babysit for the Roberts kids.
That's it. I knew there was some connection.
Yeah, so she knew the Roberts family really well.
You know, after I feel like we were there for a good like 25 minutes.
Yeah, we were there for a little while. Yeah.
We finally come back downstairs. You know, once you're up there, you kind of lose track of time. And there was plenty of time, by the way, because the movie didn't start till 12:30.
We were still 3 hours away from the movie starting.
So we finally get back downstairs. And I think what we also forgot was that John and Fifi were down there.
Right.
And they were pissed. Because they had this look of death, like, you made us sit out here. And it was like, they could have come up, but they didn't want to. So I didn't really feel that bad. You know, we all finally go back. Now it's going to be time. It's 11 o'clock when we get there. So we still have an hour and a half before the movie's even going to start. But we figured, well, you know, we'll get a good place in line. And then each one of us could run out if we need to. We get there. And the line was even bigger.
Yes.
It was completely around the block, and the start of the line actually wrapped around that. You could see the end of the line and the start of the line almost meeting each other. And we're talking about going around a whole big city
block. A whole city block, yeah. And it's a big theater. I got to, you know.
Yeah, the Ziegfeld had like 1,100 seats.
Yeah.
It was a massive. So it wasn't that we weren't going to get in. It's just that we thought we had plenty of time and we were going to get awesome seats, and it was already a super line.
Yes.
And then to make matters worse, we find out that the last show was delayed and that the movie's going to get out late. And we're not even going to get into the theater till about 12:30.
Right.
And it's going to start even later than that. So now this little lark that I think everyone's pinning on me because it was my suggestion, we got to go see it at the Ziegfeld, is starting to be.
It's starting to disintegrate.
Yes. So, you know, do you have any good line stories? I don't remember much.
I don't remember much about the line now.
Yeah. So, you know, time passes.
Except that in the line, there was this atmosphere among the people in the line. People were having a good time in line.
It felt like you were getting ready to go into a concert.
Exactly. Yes. It had that level of excitement where the crowd was, or the line, the audience were getting ready for something.
Yeah, and you know, in New York is different than a lot of other film places. Like people, it was an event to go to a movie.
Yeah,
people loved it. They wanted to be the first people to see a film. It was a thing to do, and it was just, you know, again, it was part of our sort of regimen.
Yeah.
We went to a ton of movies in those days.
But we did finally get into the movie.
We finally get in, and it's like, it is that rush of like, everyone's just really pumped. I mean, it's late, everyone's exhausted, but they're pumped. And we get in, and we got pretty good seats, as I recall. And,
yeah.
You know, we're in for this atmosphere, and everybody's just, they're cheering and getting excited. And then the movie starts, and I had, of course, just seen the movie a day before.
Right.
So I could really make a comparison of what the difference between what I watched in 35 millimeter versus what I saw in 70 millimeter, and just the brightness of the image was so sharp. I mean, we're talking when you have that opening day print that hasn't been scratched.
Oh, yeah, that hasn't been through anything. It's just pristine. Yeah.
And I mean, you know, now I think people are probably spoiled with IMAX and all that super sound. But back then,
well, back then, six track was a big deal.
I mean, six track is even better in many ways than digital, because when you're designing the digital sort of soundtrack and all the different speakers,
yeah,
there's the upper and lower sound waves are cut.
Oh, right. So there's dynamic range compression is what you're talking about. Yes.
And they all do it. And yeah. So
it's the same thing that's gone on, that's happening in music lately. If you listen to music from the 70s, it's got a huge dynamic range.
What would happen with a six track magnetic, it was completely uncompressed.
Right.
And so you'd hear all of the lows and highs that, you know, you might not necessarily even notice the sound.
Right.
You're feeling it.
And there's a fullness and a richness to the sound. Yeah.
Yeah. And even today, that now that they're kind of doing 70 millimeter prints again, there's no magnetic. Magnetic tracks are gone because it's an environmental hazard.
Oh, it is? So, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So they don't do magnetic tracks anymore. You can't really get that unless you're hearing a vintage mag print. And
right.
I do go to those festivals, and man, I tell you, when you hear these six-track mag prints, holy crap.
I bet, yeah.
The energy that you feel, there's nothing like it. I think IMAX comes close.
Right.
But, and also back then, the Ziegfeld, they had these mammoth speakers.
Yes.
They had ones that you couldn't even see that were behind the screen, but then you'd saw these huge.
Well, it's an 1,100-seat theater. You got to put some sound out to cover that.
You know, watching this movie, The Doors, I remember at the beginning, there's, you know, when he's little Jim Morrison and he's driving along with his parents and there's like a lightning storm, the crackle sound in the theater of that lightning.
Out here in the perimeter, there are no stars. Out here, we is stone, immaculate.
Was just awesome. And then, of course, the concert scenes, right? And they have lots of music. And unlike Bohemian Rhapsody, where they cut every song out after 10 seconds, they do get, you get to hear a lot of the Doors.
They
music
let the music, Stone was smart enough to let the music play. That's my big complaint about Bohemian Rhapsody.
I guess the similarities are that Bohemian Rhapsody just basically follows that formula that so many before have kind of fallen into, where you show the band get together, you show them make a few songs, and
then they become big, and then they start to argue.
Exactly.
So, yeah, and it's just the typical. Yeah, I mean, it's exactly every rock biopic is almost the same.
You know what, Val Kilmer. He's over the top and fun in the movie.
It's a good performance.
You know, it's a film of excess, much like Oliver Stone.
Like everything Oliver Stone does. So one thing I remember about this screening, I don't know if you have more, but is that in the theater it was a party.
Yes, lots of marijuana smoke going on.
There was a lot of marijuana smoke. There was drinking. It was like being at a concert environment.
It had a very raucous concert atmosphere.
Yeah, and I remember the next day, I saw George Ann Walken.
You did?
Yes.
Well, this part I didn't know.
Yeah, I saw her the next day. We were working together. I think Sheila was there too, but I specifically remember telling George Ann that I had gone to see The Doors, and she said, what was it like or something? And I said, it was totally crazy. People were drinking and smoking pot. And she said, well, it was the 60s. And I said, no, I mean in the theater. Not the people in the movie. Like, I hadn't been to a movie before where there was like that much pot smoke.
The only times that I would remember that would happen is a few screenings when I was like a young kid,
right,
at the Harvard Square Theater.
Oh yeah, that would
when
make
it
sense.
Was just a single retro house. I remember the very first time I went there, my mom took me to see this trilogy of Beatles movies.
Oh, okay, yeah.
It was the Magical Mystery Tour, which they don't really show because it was a TV movie, and Help and documentary one.
Let It Be?
Let It Be. And Let It Be was showing first, like, because they just do them continuous, so
right,
you could just
okay.
pop in. So we popped in sort of halfway through Let It Be, or maybe we missed the first 10, 15 minutes,
And every time that Yoko came on, the entire audience was booing and hissing. And I didn't know. I didn't even know who she was at the time. I was just a big Beatles fan. But everyone was going, I was like, Mom, why are they doing that? And she had to explain, like, during the movies. And then in between films, like that's when the marijuana smoke goes. And I was like, what's that smell, Mom? And she's like explaining, because I had no idea what that was. So,
right.
Yeah, I had been to a few screenings where that it took place, but not to the level it was at the Doors.
Yeah, no, it was totally out of control at the Doors.
And funny that you mentioned that, because, and I don't know if you remember this, so we're all getting up after this big journey that the movie didn't start till even 1 o'clock. So the movie's long. We probably didn't exit the theater till 3:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
And on the way out, Greg looked down at the seat in front of him, and somebody had dropped a fairly decent-sized bag of pot.
Yes.
And he, of course, grabbed that bag pocketed that. He did. And I don't know how big it was or whatever, but right. It looked pretty big to me. It was full. So we then leave, and we go to the subway. And, you know, not like most times, at 3:30 in the morning, the subway is not running at every 5 minutes.
Right. Yeah, it's on a slightly lighter schedule.
And we must have missed whatever the
previous train was. Yeah, we had to wait forever, didn't we?
It was a good 30 minutes or
yeah.
so. And we were all exhausted, and we were so tired, but we even, I think, sat down on the floor of the subway
yeah.
station. That's like how we didn't care. We were that tired. And then the reaction from everybody but myself, nobody seemed to really like the Doors that much. And everybody was like shooting daggers at me as if it was my fault that we went.
It was your fault.
Like, I remember Fifi's thinking, why did I come with you guys?
Why did I go through all of this to see that movie?
Yeah. So, you know, so we finally get back, and it must have been like 4:30 in the morning when we finally got back to the apartment.
Yeah, and, you know, I have not seen The Doors since then.
Really?
Yeah.
You saw it the one time?
I saw it the one time.
I still liked The Doors at the time, and when I got back to Massachusetts for the spring break, I remember going with my mom and a friend from high school.
Okay, so you saw it 3 times in the theater.
I went back into – I insisted that we have to go see it in 70 millimeter. And my mom took my friend Jamie and I into town to the Cinema 57, and we saw The Doors again in 70 millimeter.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and then I saw one other time at a revival screening that another friend of mine who loved The Doors, he had never seen it in the theater or something. So we went, and that was probably it. And now, you know, I think it's more of like a curiosity. Perhaps.
Yeah. I'm curious enough just from this conversation. I'm curious enough that I might have to watch it again.
There'll suddenly be a streaming run on The Doors for people hearing the show. Well, hopefully that was enjoyable. But it made me think of that story because of Greg and because Luke Perry passed. And,
right. You know, so let's.
Yeah. So that's how it goes. Okay. So that was our story on The Doors. But now a little housekeeping. You know, you had mentioned a few episodes ago, we were talking Mandy and
yes.
revenge films. And you talked about one film in particular called Blue Ruin.
I kind of talked it up on the episode.
You did. You talked it to the degree that I wanted to see the movie, but it wasn't streaming anywhere. And then I remembered it had been streaming, and that's what I always hate, is that there's a movie, it streams forever,
right.
And you want to go see, you never, like, I don't need to see that. It's streaming, it'll be available forever, and then you go to see it, and it's gone. But I don't know whether it was a listener of the show.
It was a listener of the show.
Had alerted us that it was back on.
Yes, back on Netflix.
Was that Zach that did
it? It was Zach. Yep. Okay, Zach sent me a message and said, Blue Ruin is back on Netflix.
So, Zach, thank you.
Yes.
Because I was able to tune in and to Netflix and watch it. And so I wanted to circle back with
yeah.
you to say that I did enjoy it. It's really is a classic revenge story.
It's a classic revenge story that puts some interesting twist on the genre and explores it in a way that's not exactly like every other movie in the genre.
Yeah, I mean, it's not necessarily something that we, you know, haven't seen before, but within that right. genre, it is.
Within the genre, it takes it to some interesting places, yeah.
it could have easily been like a 2-hour movie, and they could have had a lot of backstory and a lot of extra scenes that weren't needed. Yeah. Could have gone into those very familiar tropes. You know, it could have had like this kid's family could be in jeopardy at the end, you know, one of those standoff moments. And it said, we don't need to do that. Let's tell a different story, and very economically at 90 minutes.
Yes.
Take you through a journey that's just believable enough to buy.
Yes. That's a good way to put it.
Because I think that one of the things when you're watching films like this unfold, you start to ask questions like, well, why wouldn't somebody notice this? Or why aren't the cops involved? But every step of the way in this movie, when I started to ask those questions in my mind, the movie revealed answers that made sense.
Yes.
It was keeping on top of where I was going in my head. And I was very satisfied with the fact that it was doing that.
Yeah, because it's smart. It treats the audience with respect. It understands that you're smart and isn't just using a bunch of movie logic to sort of follow the revenge trip. It's bringing in a level of realism that maybe isn't there in other movies like this.
Yeah, like, for instance, you know, there's the very set of special skills there.
Right.
Liam Neeson. So the premise of a film like that is that Liam Neeson already has this background in being a professional government-sanctioned badass. And now this movie is just an excuse to get him to use those special set of skills. This movie, Blue Ruin, this guy has no special set of skills.
He has no skills whatsoever.
It would be like if a regular Joe like you or me had to come to the place where you want revenge, but how are you going to do that?
And you try to take up arms, but don't know how to use them.
Exactly. and have plans that sound smart, but executing the plans the way, like in the movie, a lot of times you have a plan and two things happen. It either goes completely to shit or it goes according to plan.
Right.
This movie, it kind of does a little bit of mixture.
It does them both at the same time, in fact.
Yeah, some of his plan is going how he thought it was going to go, but oops, all these other things didn't go right, and now he's in trouble.
Yeah, and there's things, like small things that go wrong that I really like. Like, he stabs a tire and cuts himself with the knife, and it's just little things like that. Like, he can't even slash a tire effectively.
And because of that, it actually screws his escape up.
It screws his escape up because he doesn't have the key to his car and has to take the other car that he slashed the tires of. Yeah. And it sort of snowballs in that way. Also, at the center of this movie, I think, is a great performance.
Yeah. Was his name Macon?
Macon Blair.
He has to do some very emotional acting and like, for instance, act like he's in massive, massive pain that he's going to die kind of thing. And how he's able to conjure that up, I don't know. he did a great job there.
He also, like, underneath it, there's always this loneliness kind of informing his performance. You said, when we first talked about this, you said that you had trouble with, like, the first 15 minutes or so.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is slow paced.
So I've watched the first 15 minutes of this about a dozen times.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. That's a little interesting.
Because it's so well encapsulated, that first maybe 20 minutes of the movie, and there's almost no dialogue in it.
That is true. My problem with it, those first few minutes, had something to do with the fact that, you know, to be clear, this movie is a low-budget film.
Right.
And you'll hear it early and often from me. It's my general problem with movies today. They're all shot on digital.
Right. And so you were adjusting to that at the beginning. But the thing is, like,
Because also, if you think about it, when you're a low budget movie and you do digital, you can't even use a good digital camera.
Well, yes, absolutely. But this guy knows how to frame and.
Well, that's what I was liking about it, is that while I didn't like necessarily some of the lighting and what digital does.
Yeah.
And making it look almost not like a movie. The compositions, and this was a shot in the 2:3:5 aspect ratio, but in here, the person directing it knew what to put in the frame.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So the framing and the camera movement, there's this great, this is in the first 2 or 3 minutes of the film. He's in a bathtub and the camera is slowly moving towards the bathtub. he hears something. He hears a noise, and you see his, you know, he sort of cocks his ear, and the camera stops when he hears the noise. Then the noise goes away, and the camera starts moving again. And it's really subtle, but it creates all this tension. Most people probably wouldn't even notice that it's doing that. But he's creating a lot of tension through framing and camera movement. And that's what I like about this first 20 minutes. Yeah, it looks kind of low budget, but there's no dialogue. It's all visual storytelling.
Yeah, and then that's the whole thing, is it 90 minutes, right?
Yeah.
He tells an effective story through dialogue, but also through the visual storytelling.
Exactly.
And that was what was really compelling.
And that's what I like about that first 20 minutes. That's why I've seen it so much, is that it's an example. It creates his entire backstory without dialogue.
I don't want to give this movie away, but when he goes and shows up at the prison.
Yeah.
Towards the beginning, that to me is when the movie's really kind of got going.
Yes.
I thought for a while they weren't even going to really fill you in.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And then you get filled in and there's a lot more to it than...
That's what I loved, because I really wasn't at this point. I had kind of accepted that, well, it's a little bit of a flaw in the movie. We're really not going to get some backstory.
Right.
And then we do. And that's when I'm like, you know, this is really good. This is a really good story. It's answering my questions.
It's answering your questions. Exactly. And it does all add up and it all makes sense. And there's emotional truth to it, which is sort of a hard thing to find in these kinds of movies.
It kind of takes the standpoint of, if you were a regular person and you want revenge, and it basically says that revenge isn't necessarily satisfying. It doesn't necessarily solve things. It might actually make things worse.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I thought it was a great movie, and it's definitely one that people should, you know, throw into their basket of movies to see.
Yeah. And it's, you know, I mean, it's got a little bit of violence in it.
Well, and you know what? It's very realistic violence.
It's very realistic violence. That's what I was going to say in comparing it to Mandy, which is sort of surrealistic, blood drenched violence. This is very realistic. This whole movie is very realistic, I think.
Yeah. And that's where, I mean, I guess the scenes that are violent in this movie are very shocking.
They are very shocking. Yes. There's nothing gratuitous about it.
Yes. Yes. You're better with those words than I am. Yes. There's nothing gratuitous about the violence in this movie, but it is, you know, it's not for, it, again, with a revenge story, it's not for everyone.
Right. As far as revenge movies go, this is one of the more interesting ones.
This same director followed it up with an even bigger hit, The Green Room.
Green Room. Yeah.
Not Green Book, but... Don't get those confused, because you're going to be very shocked at both films touch on racial prejudices, but one is about as far different than the other.
Yes. So stay.
But you didn't like that Green Room as much as you liked Blue Ruin.
I did like Green Room a lot, actually.
Some similar territory, though.
There's some similar territory. I think what it really comes down to is the central performance in Blue Ruin really I connected with. And Green Room didn't have a character that I connected with in that way.
Yeah, it was. I mean, that part of the stories are different. But the director, Jeremy Saulnier?
Saulnier.
He most recently did the first two episodes of the new True Detective series.
Yes.
And those two episodes really kicked things off well. And I thought this was going to be a pretty good season. And then it kind of goes downhill from there. And I really couldn't recommend the third season of True Detective. But I did like those first two episodes a lot.
So he also has another movie that's on Netflix, which I haven't seen yet, called Hold the Dark.
Oh, is that actually on Netflix?
Yeah, it was made for Netflix.
Oh, I heard about this, but I wasn't making the connection.
Yeah.
Who's in that?
Jeffrey Wright, Alexander Skarsgård.
One of those Skarsgårds.
Yeah, so he directed that. It's based on a book. Yeah, it takes place in Alaska. I haven't watched it yet.
That's it. That was what it was. It takes place in Alaska.
Yeah, so that's on Netflix. But he's, you know, Blue Ruin was a Kickstarter movie.
Really?
He was a DP who wanted to make a movie.
Huh.
And so, yeah, it's actually a Kickstarter movie.
Cool.
Yeah. I would say, as far as very low budget movies go, yeah, it's got that digital look, but the cinematography is not that bad for a super low budget movie.
No, not saying it gets better, but I got used to it.
Yes,
and
exactly.
Because the story was really good. It was very engrossing. And then, you know, again, his compositions.
Yeah, his direction is great.
it was just always weird that we have to talk about these films and recommend them, but we don't want to give them away. And
right.
In this film, I think part of the enjoyment is just sit back and watch this unfold, because there's a lot of good stuff going on.
Yeah, and unfold is exactly the right word. You sort of have these assumptions about things, and so does the character. And then new information is revealed, and it sort of deepens and complexifies the whole thing.
So I thank you, sir, for the recommendation.
I'm glad that this was not another triangle.
Well, nobody put a gun to my head and said I had to watch Triangle. I thought it would just be fun. And, you know, they can't all be winners, right? I'm going to recommend some movies that, you know, eventually you'll see. And how you doing with that Roma? Are you getting any closer?
I'm never going to watch Roma. I've decided I'm committed now to never watching Roma.
Which is, here's what's really weird about that.
No, I'm joking. I'm joking.
I know. But what's weird is that you saw Cold War.
Yes.
And, you know, just for you listeners, we still haven't really talked about it. I went to see Cold War, and I had to actually go out of my way to see it. It was not playing anywhere near me. I went and saw it 50 minutes away, and I was determined. I was kind of like, I am going to show that Teal. I'm going to see that Cold War. And we were going to talk. We talked about it on the episode.
On the lost episode.
Yeah, the lost episode. So that the weekend that I saw it, on that Saturday, my son had a hockey game in like the Montpelier or whatever.
Right.
And I found out that Cold War was playing in Montpelier at an art house.
Oh, okay.
And he had like another game like later that afternoon. It was like a double, but there was like a few hours in between.
Okay.
And so, I know. It was, because this was like a state champion. Well, it wasn't state champion. It was like the playoffs.
So, wait, did you abandon your child and go see the
movie? No. So originally, I thought that I was going to go up, just him and I, but then my wife and my youngest were coming. But the thought was that I was going to make him go see Cold War with me.
Oh, okay.
Because I was like, well, you know what? He can handle subtitles, and it's probably not for him, but I'll explain that it's probably not for you, and it's okay if you're tired and just take a nap. So it was all set, but then my wife decided that she was coming up for both games, and we ended up doing something else instead. So I wasn't able to go.
Oh, so you had to make a separate trip.
So the next day, we had to finish up the playoffs, which my son did not. They didn't go. They didn't advance, but when I got home from that, I then got everybody out of the car, and then I drove 50 minutes further south from our house and went and saw Cold War at some small town theater in Manchester, Vermont.
Okay.
And I really, really enjoyed it.
It was worth it then.
For me, yeah. I liked seeing movies on the big screen, you know?
Yeah.
And a film like Cold War, and this is why I like the Roma thing, while I was joking, is that movie I saw on Netflix. That's what it, you know, it's a Netflix.
Right.
Movie, but it really begs to be seen on a giant screen.
Yeah.
And I really, really liked and respected Roma, but I feel that if I ever got to see it on the big screen, I might just fall in love with it.
Yeah. So I had a friend who loved Roma, and she said she saw it in 70 millimeter on the big screen. And she said that she fell in love with it, but that everyone she knows who watched it on TV didn't like it.
I think that's okay. I mean, this is not your typical plot-driven action film.
Right. It's a...
I myself was, like, watching it for the first time, kind of going, I thought I was expecting more of a story.
Right.
And I got past that because it stayed with me. We talk about the staying power of a movie.
Yeah.
And it just stayed with me and stayed with me. And it's created some moments and images that I think are going to live on for years and years.
Okay. See,
Like Cold War.
I do really want to watch it, but I have some resistance to it.
Well, maybe your resistance is that it's been hyped and not hyped, and you don't know where you're going to fall. So you're going to watch it, and then you might be disappointed and have to come back and say, I didn't like Roma, which I think would be fascinating. And then we could have a little debate about it. So,
okay. I guess I will watch it after all.
Everyone out there in listener land, someday Teal will have seen Roma.
One of these days I will have seen Roma and we'll talk about it on the show.
And you will either love it or you will think it's a big bag of flaming crap. We don't know yet. We just don't know. All right. Well, listen, it's been fun. It's been real. And now we must say goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Till next time, everyone. Later.